thank the Totem residences for offering us this place to give the lecture and to stress how this lecture is indeed conceived for students in residence and how happy we are to see all the students here. Sir Isaiah Berlin, formerly holder of one of the most distinguished chairs at Oxford, the Fitcherley Professorship of Political and Social Theory, and now president of Wolfson College at Oxford, is truly one of the great intellectuals of our time. He has made outstanding contributions to philosophical thought, to the history of ideas, to the study of Russian literature, and to Russian intellectual history, the field of tonight's lecture entitled The Russians' Obsession with History and Historicism. Indeed, so wide-ranging are Sir Isaiah's interests that he defies classification by any narrow disciplinary approach. Philosopher, critic, historian, political thinker, he is all of these. But more than that, he has that rare gift of being able to share with those fortunate enough to hear him in a most inspiring yet witty way his erudition and his wisdom. Those who attended his Monday afternoon lecture have already had vivid proof of this quality. To those who are hearing him tonight for the first time, I need only say, listen. Sir Isaiah.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I begin by thanking Professor Sinel for introducing me so generously. I can only say that it probably does more credit and reveals more about his heart and his generosity than about my qualities. And for this, I'm most grateful to him. I return the compliment in double form. Now, I was going to speak tonight about Russian historicism and history. So far as straight history is concerned, I dare say as many Russians have been interested in history as anybody else anywhere else, and in a perfectly normal fashion too. But the subject which I propose to talk about is a particular influence upon certain sections of them, particular interpretations of history, which seem to me to have made a very great deal of difference to their national existence during the last 150 years, and through that, to all of us. There are a great many motives for study of history. Let me mention 8 or 9, at least. To begin with, people study history because of the solidarity it conveys. We're all the sons of Cadmus. We're all Trojans. The first Frenchman was Francia, who came from Troy, the French were taught before the 16th century. The English were taught they were all children of a Trojan called Brutus. Anything which promotes national solidarity tends to excite interest in history. It increases national cohesion. That's what the sociologists teach. We're all the sons of Troy, but all the sons of Abraham, but all the sons of the same dragon. That is one thing. Second one is patriotism, glory, fast achievement, inspire us. This great truth occurs also. The third is simply as material for the sciences, material for theology, material for social psychology, simply natural philosophy teaching with material gleaned from history in the way in which, say, Cicely did it, or perhaps Hume, as sociologists of the 19th and 20th century. Or perhaps it's simply a school of morals. You pick out the bad and the good moments in history. Like Voltaire, like Macaulay, you point out moments which are progressive and splendid, and you point out moments which are squalid and vicious and bloodstained in order to teach people to avoid them. This is what is called philosophy teaching by example. Then there is, for example, the use of history simply for, as I say, straight political purposes, in which you simply teach history as a struggle between rationalism and irrationalism, or clericalism and anti-clericalism, or left and right. This is a school of history very well known nowadays. Or perhaps it's a school of which represents history as a great drama, a great divine drama, beginning with the creation of man and ending with the transfiguration, with the second coming, with all the great historical personages and periods who live out this great God-inspired and God-written dramatic succession of episodes in the way in which it is written about in the Bible and in the way in which Augustine treated it, or various medieval philosophers, or Bossuet, or in its secular form, thinkers like Schelling and Hegel and Marx. Or it's a school of self-understanding in which we understand human beings better and more profoundly through understanding in what way we came, what we came out of, and why we're here, and where we're going, in the way in which, say, Vico or Herder taught men, or to some extent Marx also, the self-translation of man in the course of shaping his own history. or it's a sort of ballet or folk dance conception, as in Herder, in which each human group has its own particular part to play and dance onto the stage in response to certain lyrical cues, so that every dog has his day, every nation, every human group appears in due course and proceeds to realize itself in some fashion, which contributes to the civilization of the whole. This is the conception of the garden with many flowers, each of which flowers, however, historically in a certain tempo, at a certain point. Finally, there is the motive of simple curiosity, just to find out what happened and why. If you ask what it is that fixed itself upon the imagination of the Russians, it's the penultimate of these motives, namely, the notion of each human group having its own part to play, appearing in time at a certain point, and realizing itself in its own unique, peculiar fashion. And if you ask why this is so, it is because the Russians, as I tried to point out in my yesterday's lecture, were a late comer to the great Western feast. They developed late as a world power only in the early 19th century. They felt that they were looked upon, as I say, as powerful but barbarous. Like all nations that were in economically or socially backward, they had a feeling that they must in some way demonstrate their powers, they must find some part to play, they must show that they too have some kind of role to execute in the great unrolling of the human carpet. And any philosophy which taught that every powerful human group surely has a moment at which it occupies the stage, at which it teaches the rest of humanity, at which its message becomes the compelling message upon all mankind, any such doctrine is like to commend itself to a vigorous, ambitious group of human beings who had hitherto not played any significant part and who were both conscious of youth and strength and ambition and at the same time felt themselves to be uneducated, ignorant, barbarous and feared and despised by the more developed nations of the West. This happened to the Germans in the 18th century and to the Russians in due course in the 19th and to a good many people in the 20th century all around the globe who are not very difficult to think of. Now, the fundamental motive, therefore, which dominated these Russians, particularly in the early 1820s, 1830s, was, if you like, a kind of search for a libretto. Herzen put it very vividly when he said, ask the question, has history a libretto? And if history has a libretto, like an opera, what part in it has been assigned to us? I won't go over again what I said to you about Radaev yesterday, who condemned his own people for having no past, and wondered if they really did have some role to play in history, and wondered why they'd been created. After Chardaev had been condemned for lunacy, in daring to say that the Russians had no significant history and might perhaps have no very significant part to play, he duly repented, as others have done since his day. And in his later work, he no longer insisted upon the gloomy and meaningless past of Russia, but said on the contrary, in a famous essay called Apology of a Madman, Apologie d'un Fou, he says, it may be that coming late to the Feast of the Nations carried its own advantages. After all, Europe is probably at the end of the They are finishing, we are beginning. It's the well-known cry of developing nations. Maybe a special role has been reserved for us. Maybe there is a certain special advantage in being backwards because they will have invented all the weapons of modern civilization. They have gone through terrible industrial hell for the purpose of creating the advanced weapons of civilization, the machinery and technology, which is being developed now. We are able to profit by this without going through the agonies through which we have gone. We can profit by their labors without paying the price. This notion that lateness carries its own reward, that if you come late, you can profit by the gifts or by the inventions of others without necessarily having to earn them, by the kind of tortures and the kind of labor which the others have had to spend, is something which Chardaev is, I think, the first to enunciate. It is then repeated by Herzen. It is repeated by Chernyshevsky, who was an early Russian socialist thinker in the 60s and the 70s. It was finally repeated by the late Mr. Deutscher when he explained why it is nations in Asia, nations in Africa have to have better chance of succeeding than the exhausted nations of the West. This is a well-known, well-known object of hope. It's a well-known prop to people who feel that their resources in the past have been somewhat inadequate, and therefore there may be something to be said for starting with an absolute blank sheet. This is certainly a doctrine which becomes fairly frequently repeated in Russia in the middle of the 19th century. The other motive, of course, is that with the decay of the authority of the church and with the general decay of religion in the early 19th century, they needed some substitute, some faith, some goal to which to fix themselves. And it appeared to them that these historical doctrines which they derived from the Germans, principally from Herder and from Hegel, in which history is a kind of drama with many acts and scenes, in which therefore there is a certain order through, in terms of which various nations come through various trap doors on the stage in order to play their part. If this could be believed, offered them the certainly the firmest hope of doing something significant, of acquiring a kind of proud national self-identity which they were in particular need of, for which they felt a particular necessity. This kind of ersatz religion can be felt particularly strongly in the writings of Russian critics in the 30s and the 40s. As I tried to say yesterday, if we take the critic Belinsky, he was a man who really tried to live the doctrines of Hegel. Once he decided that Hegel was right and that everything which happened in history had its explanation, and therefore that everything which happened in history could be justified by being a historical necessity coming when it does, he really tried to live this doctrine, even though it committed him to various disagreeable consequences. Nobody has ever tried to live doctrines with the intensity and with the earnestness and with the depth of the Russians. I mean, there have been lots of historical philosophers of history since Hegel. After all, there are the philosophies of Spengler, there are the philosophies of Professor Toynbee. You may believe in Toynbee's doctrine, you may not, but nobody has ever tried to live Toynbee. The Russians are the only people who really have tried to live through something which they genuinely believed in this sense. In this sense, the Russian intellectuals of the 30s and 40s attempted in their very lives to behave like people upon whom it was incumbent to realize certain values which only the 1830s and 1840s would bring to fruition. They asked themselves what history was like. They decided the Germans were right, that if there was to be a science of history, and they believed in science, because science was the only great liberating force of the modern world which would forever kill superstition, which would forever kill ignorance, and prejudice, and all the horrors of the past. If there is a science, there must be a pattern. There must be a pattern which can be understood. If there is a pattern, the question to ask is, where do we occur in this pattern? Where are we? Where do we come in? Which stage have we reached? And this is what preoccupies a good many Russian thinkers in the middle 50s. The entire argument between the Slavophiles and the Westerners, which is a well-known argument in Russia in the 19th century, takes a deeply historical form. On the one hand, there are the Slavophiles say, we have our own unique path. We needn't follow the West. Someone like the thinker Homyakov says, look at what is in the West. There are two tendencies there. On the one hand, the Roman Church, which has become decayed, which has simply produced a kind of feeble bureaucracy and enfeebled authoritarian order without any spirit, without any soul, which at present oppresses the decadent peoples of France and of Italy. On the other hand, the revolt against it is in the direction of Protestantism. Protestantism is simply a kind of atomizing force which splits people up into mere individuals and has robbed them of all creative urge, which has destroyed their sense of community, and which has made of each man a watertight little island, unable to communicate with others, totally self-centered and self-concentrated. We, fortunately, through the schism, because we have not participated in these heresies of the West, have preserved freshness, creativity, a nearness to Christ, a nearness to God, a certain kind of spiritual liberty and a natural sense of community which we alone of all the human tribes have possessed, and this we must carefully cultivate. On no account must we imitate these decayed and unworthy representatives of the Christian religion. Hence, tremendous stress on our Russian past and tremendous condemnation of Peter the Great, who had the temerity and made the ghastly blunder of trying to imitate the West and so kill the natural spontaneity of the Slav spirit, the one thing which we can be proud of, the unruined, unspoiled, unbent, free Russian spirit which beats in the breast of our uncorrupted peasants. It may no longer beat in the breast of our semi-corrupted bourgeoisie. It is dead in the breast of our wholly corrupted bureaucracy. But if you go to the villages, you will still there find great, the broad Russian nature, the uncorrupted, smiling Russian faces which augur, which are symptoms of far freer and far nobler development than the busy, neurotic, oppressed, caricature figures, so to speak, running about the streets of Paris and of London will now show. This is the Slavophiles. I slightly caricatured their doctrine, but the essence of it is, I think, more or less as I've stated it. In answer to this, there are the Westerners, Granovsky, Belinsky, Chernyshevsky, various, but they not at all. If science is science, then the same pattern must be followed by all men qua men. What the West has done, we shall have to do too. The very notion of a separate state being reserved for us, of something special being reserved for us, the fact that we have alone have been accepted by God from the terrible fate of other nations. The others have gone to their doom through following false paths, but we alone have been preserved to be the saviors of mankind, which Dostoevsky afterwards said. This is surely unscientific, whatever else it may be. If men are they are, if there is a human nature which can be examined scientifically, if there are laws which can be discovered about how human societies evolve in relation to their environment, in relation to the surrounding nature, and in relation to the particular organs with which they are endowed, if there is such a thing, then it's perfectly clear that there cannot be any exceptions. If a thing is a cow, it's going to have a cow-like fate. If a creature is human, it must have a human fate. If one is a nation, one must have the fate of a nation. All nations must go through the same hoops, with minor variations perhaps, but in general through the same kind of process. Therefore, we are simply backward. Peter the Great was perfectly right. What he did was to drive us in a rather brute manner, in a rather precipitate manner, but still drive us onto the main road of human civilization. And thank God we are there. We paid a very heavy price for it, but if we hadn't done that, we should have been where the Eskimos are now. And therefore, we must go forward. All this talk about the Russian commune, all this talk about Russian freedom, all this talk about the broad Russian soul has not saved other nations from doom. The Arabs also have had communal existence. They've also had a mir. They've also had an obstinate, as it's called, also had some kind of communal existence of which the Saudis are so proud, and yet they've nothing of it. There is absolutely no point in inviting us to go through the fate of the Arabs of the Arabian Desert. And so there is an argument, a well-known argument about whether Peter the Great was a noble savior or an obsessed lunatic. And this, and criminal indeed, and this continues through the 30s, 40s, and the 50s. The ground of it is entirely historical. Both parties appeal, not so much to history as to patterns in history, to some kind of pattern of how human beings develop. Each grounds its arguments entirely on historical arguments. And each advocates this course rather than that course on the ground that this is now historically visible. The Slavophiles, because we're fulfilling Slav nature, and this is the way to do it. The Westerners, because this is the path to justice, civilization, light, and to everything which the English and the French have already done and still have to do. Now, let me explain to you that this obsession with where are we on the ladder of civilization? Have we reached stage 17 or are we still at stage 9? Which particular step are we on in order to calculate what particular step is appropriate? This is something which is really not thinkable in the West. The notion, so to speak, that everything must be adjusted to a particular position in an abstract schema in which we believe as much as ever people ever believed in the word of God in an earlier stage. In fact, history now replaces the divine word. History replaces faith and religion. History becomes that great external, so to speak, authority in terms of which we justify or condemn acts. When persons in the West go about saying, what is to be the fate of England? What is to be the fate of France? Tout de Buracy, the destinies of Russia, becomes an obsessive subject to the novelists, to the historians, to the social thinkers, to everybody who's concerned with Russia. What is to be our fate? Where are we going? Are we going to be destroyed by the Western nations? Are we forever going to lag behind them? Or on the contrary, are we going to overtake them? Are we going to be as good as them? Or even better, have we a special fate? Have we a duty towards them? Have they a duty towards us? Are we the messianic nations who are going to save them? Or on the contrary, are the home of darkness and barbarism, never to be saved from the dreadful yoke of this ghastly government? And so on and so on. When Western thinkers ask themselves questions, they do not ask themselves questions in this form. If when Michelet, let's say, a French historian, much obsessed by the sort of history, when he denounces the Jesuits, or when he denounces Napoleon III as a tyrant, or whatever he may do, he doesn't say to himself, have the Jesuits betrayed the French business? Is Napoleon III a traitor to the laws of history? It wouldn't mean anything. When John Stuart Mill wants to know whether this or that course of action is the proper course of action for the English nation in 1860, or whatever it may be, he doesn't ask himself, what is the historical obligation of a nation like the English in 1862? Where, on which particular rung of the ladder of civilization are we at the moment, and what does this rung demand of us? This notion that history makes certain demands upon you, that you must behave in accordance with what the historical moment exacts from you, that there is a kind of inexorable pattern on which you are to find yourself, and having found yourself on the map, this itself somehow conveys or instills certain directions about behavior. This is typical of people who cannot as yet trust themselves, trust their own moral sense, as John Stuart Mill could, can't trust their political convictions, as Michelet could, and have to have recourse to some outside authority. In the old days, the word of God. In the new days, the new science of history, which is a kind of vademecum, which is something which gives you answers to all the deepest questions of national and individual existence. We'll find that this thing goes right on. I mean, let me give you an example of the sort of idea. For example, the historian Chicherin, in the middle of the 19th century, argues that the Russian constitution cannot be obtained. A liberalization of the Tsarist regime isn't on because we are still at such and such a stage of the Hegelian evolution. Since when you're at a rather early stage, we may have to wait centuries for all the trials, for all the thesis and antithesis and synthesis to be gone through, and the synthesis to produce its own antithesis, and this produce its own synthesis. All this has gone through patiently. The corridor must be gone through stage by stage. You can't skip stages. History is an absolute inexorable kind of problem, and the idea of trying to skip stages is mere childishness. Herzen, writing to Bakunin in the late 60s, Bakunin wants to make a revolution at once, says you don't understand. Revolutions cannot be made now. In liberated slaves cannot construct buildings which are capable of giving freedom. Out of the bricks of slavery, out of the bricks of a prison, no free man's dwelling can be constructed. We have been through centuries of with denounced injustice, arbitrariness, monstrosity. Patience, patience. History has its own tempo. Gradually we must educate our people towards these rewards. And there is a certain rhythm of history to which we must adjust ourselves. If you don't adjust yourself to this rhythm, if you do make a revolution, if you do have a putsch, you will find that history will avenge herself. But in fact, instead of creating a free community, you will merely create a new slave community to replace the old one. You will exchange one yoke for another. History cannot be mocked. This kind of semi-personification of history as a kind of external force which governs you and we must very carefully study in order to be able to adjust yourself to its movement is something, as I say, which is, I won't say unique about the Russians, because the Germans show traces of it too, but which the Russians exhibit in a far more vivid degree than any other people. Take, for example, the great argument between the populists in the 70s about what we ought to do. I'll give you an example of it. The Jacobin, neo-Jacobin Tkachov, was a man who thought that the only way to liberate the Russian people was by means of a putsch. We can't work with the peasants. We can't listen to what the peasants say. The peasants are the enormous mass of Russia, but they are stupid, reactionary, and treacherous. We can liberate them, but we can't expect them to liberate themselves. We can do something for them, but we can do nothing with them. If we trust the peasants, they will simply hand over to the police, which in effect what did happen. It was all those young men who in the early years of the 1870s did go into the country and did try and help the peasants, but they obviously had such genteel accents, they were clearly so unlike the peasants, in spite of their clothes, that the peasants were naturally suspicious and handed them over to the authorities in droves. But, and therefore, the only way of promoting a proper revolution is by having a small, well-organized conspiracy of full-time professional revolutionaries who will seize power and hold it, if need be, against the peasants, in order to liberate these very peasants, if need be, against their will. To this, the more moderate populist Lavrov says that if you do that, you'll be behaving like the Jacobins in France. The appeal is always to history. Look at what happened there. They seize power, then in order to protect themselves against counter-revolutionaries, they must have to militarize themselves. The militarization, I mean, the very act of having to hold on to power in order to prevent people from overthrowing you, brutalizes you and militarizes you and makes you ultimately suppress the people whom you are trying to liberate in the very act of trying to resist the counter-revolution. Anything which makes you into a besieged army tends to brutalize you, tends to make you into an oppressor, and once you become an oppressor, the question of survival becomes important, the question of the self-perpetuation of your power, and you will never liberate them at all. To which Tkachov said, yes, it's all very well you're saying that, but look at other examples of history. If you wait, that will happen to you, which happened in the last centuries in France and in England and in Germany. Where do we get our revolutionaries from? We get them from the educated classes, we get them from among the doctors, we get them from among the engineers, we get them from among the agrarian experts, we get them from among the lawyers whose lives are made miserable by the oppressive and idiotic regime of Tsarist Russia. But if they're intelligent, they will do something. They will provide scientists with laboratories, they will give doctors employment, they will employ the engineers in state enterprises, they will use agricultural experts to improve the peasants, and they will buy them off. All they need is simply opportunities for work, for creative work. Once they do that, they'll cease to be revolutionary. The fire will go out of them, and then you won't be able to make the revolution at all. You needn't worry. The Russian government, in fact, did not display such intelligence. But the analogies were with what happened in France in the 18th century, towards the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th. By giving opportunities to these very men, they managed to disarm potential revolutionaries. Therefore, the appeal in both cases entirely is historical examples. There isn't very much appeal to direct moral principles or direct political principles, as there would certainly have been in the case of similar disputes in France or England or in America and so, or even in Germany. Similarly, you see, almost every argument in the 60s and 70s takes this particular form. Where are we? What point of path have we reached? which particular rung of the ladder, which step of the advance we made. That is why I wish to convey to you that when Marxism finally came to Russia in a serious way, which happened towards the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s, its seeds fell on immensely fertile soil. Already the soil was prepared for historicism in this sense. Already it was prepared to believe that what the great authorities of the West said was true. Another characteristic of these Russians is, of course, immense bowing before foreign authorities. Having none of their own, you always quote texts. If you want to prove a point, you don't prove it so much from empirical observation. Sometimes, of course, with historical examples, but not very much independent sociological thought. What happens is you say, Buckle says, Mill says, Spencer says, Darwin says. And these things have enormous authority. Not because these men are so important, as because they're somehow in the confidence of history. They are scientists. History is a science. These men have the secret. They have the key. They have the pattern. And if they say that, surely, surely, this is what Western scientists believe. And who are we poor fools to resist the onward march of this great science, which covers history as well? So when Marxism came, to speak, it fell, as I say, on very fertile soil, and the seeds sprouted. Someone like the socialist revolutionaries who were not Marxists were genuinely terrified by what Marxism taught, because what Marxism taught them was some form of determinism, as you can see, and some kind of pattern in history which cannot be avoided. I do not wish to be a toe on the leg of history, said Mikhailovsky. I don't wish to be dominated, to believe myself to be dominated by some huge force over which I have no control. Now, let me tell you. Freedom of the will, determinism, is a famous human problem, which people have worried about from the days of the Stoics, at least, until the present day. And people have, it is no doubt an agonizing problem, both for philosophers and sometimes for ordinary men. But the Russians are the only people where the problem of free will actually made a difference to political propaganda. When Mikhailovsky uttered these things and other socialist revolutionaries objected that if there was a grim determinism prevailing in the world, then perhaps there was no point in running enormous dangers. If history is going to, in fact, according to Marx, is going to do the job for us, first you have the feudal regime, then you have early industrialism, then you have developed industrialism, then you have the industrialists training an army of workers, in a sense, against their own purpose, but they train them to become their own gravediggers. Then you have the revolution made by the workers, which inevitably ends in the victory of the proletariat and the emergence of the classless society. If this is inevitable, why should we today take risk imprisonment and death, when by simply waiting, it might take a little longer, but there's absolutely no point in taking unnecessary risks. History, the stars in our courses, are going to do the job for us. In order to stop the party from falling into this rather gloomy condition, the thinker Peter Struve, writing in the 90s, has actually to persuade his party that although 90% of history is determined, 10% is not. Nobody else. You don't get Kautsky in Germany. You don't get Kautsky or Bernstein in Germany. You don't get Jaurès in France. You don't get William Morris or somebody in England, all of whom are socialists touched by Marxism, having to persuade their followers that although as to 90%, they can't help themselves, because in a sense they're the sort of playthings and pawns of some great impersonal process. Yet there is a corner of 10% where perhaps a certain amount of free will prevails, and therefore the game isn't completely up. It's all right. There is some room for individual enterprise and initiative. But in Russia, Struve, who is a perfectly serious thinker, has to work out a doctrine in accordance with which, although 90% is basically foreclosed, you can't do anything about that, 10% is free, so it's worth doing certain things after all. It's worth organizing, it's worth taking risks, it's worth having strikes, it's worth pressing the government, it's worth having conspiracies and the rest of it. This is a very neat situation, but as I say, let me give you another example. The socialist revolutionaries, emerging from the reading of the from study of the agrarian question, realized, of course, at a certain point, that if Marx was right, and if the condition for a successful revolution was having an enormous industrial proletariat, which was in fact the majority of the nation, then the Russians, the majority of whose population, 90% or 92% in the 70s, of whose population were simply agricultural or peasants, hadn't any chance of having a revolution in their lifetime. They'd have to wait for a very long time. And the Marxist Tikhanov, the teacher of Lenin, did indeed say, it's no good, we've got to get through it, got to get through the corridor, we must now help the capitalists, create the capitalist regime, they will breed the proletariat, and the proletariat will overthrow them. We're still at the rather early stage of this process, you can't jump these stages, we've now got to help the capitalists to create the order which is going to oppress us into liberation. This was a very disagreeable prospect for people who thought that no condition was worse than having an oppressed proletariat, having ghastly conditions of the Industrial Revolution with all its horrors. Nevertheless, if history was science, all these stages was on. So the socialist revolutionists wrote, one of them at least, or two of them, wrote letters to Karl Marx and said, do we have to go through this particular stage? Is there not some method of attaining socialism through the peasant commune circumnavigating? By must we really go through the horrors of industrialization, of the proletariat, of exploitation, of surplus value, of the entire bag of tricks? Well, Marx naturally at first wasn't very pleased by this. He said, I mean, this is childish. I mean, you were asking me to exempt you from the laws of history, like a sort of headmaster. I mean, could they have a sort of special arrangement made with history? This is really too naive. On the other hand, although he despised and disliked Slavs for the greater part of his life, in the 70s was a period of extreme reaction in Europe. It happened after the crushing of the French Commune, when the chances of any kind of left movement in Europe were very dim. The only people who appeared to him to display any kind of initiative were the Russians. There, at least, some governors were. There were some bombs which did go off. The revolutionaries did show a certain amount of individual courage and stamina. They all came, and when I say all, three or four of them who managed out, came to pay homage to Marx and recognize him as the greatest revolutionary theorist in the world. It would need an even stronger nature than Marx not to yield to the profound and sincere veneration which these brave and heroic men evidently showed to the old man in London. And so he relented somewhat. And he wrote them a letter in which he said, well, when I was writing Das Kapital, when I was evolving my theory of historical materialism, I wasn't thinking about Eastern Europe at all. I was really thinking about the West, which is true enough. In your conditions, well, he said, in certain conditions you might be able to do it. If, for example, there is a world revolution to sustain you on its shoulders, because if there isn't a world revolution, the other capitalist countries will extinguish your revolution. They will see, however successful may be in promoting it. If there is a world revolution, it's just possible you may be able to attain, go straight into socialism without entering the long and painful stage of factory industrialization. However, of course, this is very uncertain and so on, but there is a chance. Now, you must understand the position of the Marxist Party. The Marxists really believed in the literal inspiration of Marxist texts. They believed terribly in the authority of the great scientists of the West, as great naive people are liable to do. When Tsikhanov, who was a faithful Marxist, self-converted in about 1883, or so, perhaps a little later, discovered that this letter had been written, he realized that the publication of it would cause absolute havoc in the Russian Marxist Party. If Marx gave them the faintest hope of being able to circumvent the necessity of industrialization and of breeding a proletariat, not only would the socialist revolutionaries have turned out to be writers against faithful Marxists, but the Marxists themselves might become demoralized. And so he suppressed the letter. The letter was published, I think, for the first time in 1923 or 24, well after everybody's death, so to speak, well after the revolution. Now, the point I wish to make is this, that he was right from his point of view. It wouldn't have been necessary to suppress a letter by Marx in any other country. That is the point I wish to make. If Marx had written a letter of a somewhat heretical, non-Marxist type, so to speak, to Kautsky in Germany or to Bernstein, if he had written in these terms to Monsieur Jules Guesde, who was the leader of the Marxist Socialists in France, it might have stimulated an amount of lively discussion in the socialist organs. People might have said he means this or he means that. We ought to interpret his text in this way or in that way. Or we've learned from history. Marxism is not a dogma. It has to be applied in the creative and spontaneous fashion to the changing circumstances of the time. Some people would have said, well, perhaps the old man was nodding when he wrote this. Perhaps he wrote it rather late in life. Perhaps his earlier writings are more important. At any rate, I don't think there would have been anything more except a lively debate. But in Russia, it would have created a disaster in the party. And Plekhanov was absolutely right, from his point of view, in suppressing this document, which afterwards caused fearful indignation among the people who still remembered him when they discovered what he had done. Because from the point of view of preserving the cohesion and the faith of the Russian movement, these kinds of heresies had to be kept dark, even when they preceded the source of all orthodoxy himself. Consequently, as I say, the letter was suppressed. But I'm only giving you this as an illustration of the passionate faith of the total adherence to what might be called the notion of the inevitable historical pattern upon which the whole of late Russian Marxism was securely founded. And Marxism was an attractive doctrine because at the time when the police had finally caught up with individual revolutionary terrorism, which had in fact succeeded in assassinating the Emperor Alexander II, when they finally disbanded the terrorist movement, Marxism was a kind of relief because it at once said individual terrorism was no use, and when people said, what should we do? The answer was, you must go to the British Museum or its equivalent, study history, and after you've discovered the proper theory of history, then gradually build up a party, a propaganda, and then go through all the historical stages patiently, one by one. This was a very great relief to people who didn't want either to risk their lives or go to jail. Above all, because it also offered a happy ending to the story. The success in the end was guaranteed. There's nothing that inspires people so much as the conviction that stars and courses are fighting for them. And this Marxism genuinely guaranteed more than any other movement of its time. If you ask about Lenin, for example, I don't wish to multiply examples, he was absolutely steeped in this kind of historical mythology. In 1896, or then about, and I don't guarantee the date, being impatient by nature and being rather gloomy at the thought that a long period of industrialization was needed before the revolution could possibly be a success in a peasant country, which is what Western Marxists were certainly maintaining, being, as I say, somewhat discouraged by it, he tried to work out a theory whereby, after all, peasants were peasant proprietors. Proprietors were capitalists. If what you needed was a capitalist regime in a high period of development, maybe Russian agriculture, in a rather eccentric fashion, could be regarded as a high capitalist regime in an advanced state of development. Therefore, perhaps the chances of an early revolution were not all that dim. Well, he was ultimately dissuaded out of this, naturally enough. But the mere attempt to try and adapt the Marxist doctrine to rather recalcitrant Russian conditions shows this absolute desire, so to speak, to try and fit into the proper slot history. Otherwise, there was no hope. Similarly, in 1905, for example, the revolution of 1905, the question arose, where are we on the historical scale? Are we in 1848 or are we later? What sort of revolution should we make? Should we read Marx's Rights of 1850, which tell us that the proper way for a proletarian party to proceed is to make a revolution together with the liberals and then gradually sabotage the liberals and take over power, which is Marx's advice of about 1850, or on the contrary, do we read the Marx of the 1860s, who says that the only thing to do is slow educational process, propaganda, the creation of cadre of conscious workers who will gradually lead the proletariat, which by this time will have become the physical majority of the country. Depending on the answer on which Marx you read, your political tactics will follow. Certainly, they will only follow and they will only be valid if they can somehow be attached to and read off the book, which itself is a key to the actual structure of modern, the history and development and pattern of modern society. In other words, the fixation, so to speak, upon historicism in this particular sense is very, very great. History becomes, as I say, what God was to Calvinists, what God was to Calvinists versus Catholics, or Catholics versus Calvinists, what the will of God was to Muslims versus Christians, or Christians versus Muslims. Even in 1947, Stalin was still able to kill quite a lot of people for the crime of ignoring the true historical laws of economic development. I don't want to say that every Russian was affected by this. I only wish to say that the particular clan, the particular, so to speak, group of persons who in fact affected Russian history, namely the intellectual who in fact gave its tone to the intelligentsia, gave its tone to radical Russian thought, and ultimately produced the only party which in fact in 1917 appeared organized enough and able enough to seize power and to use it to effective account, that these people were intoxicated with the notion of the historical pattern. And this is what gave them their strength, their hope, and in a sense militated in favor of their success. There's nothing that succeeds so well as a coherent doctrine, whether or not the facts fit. If the facts don't fit, you simply bend them to the doctrine. That also is a way of succeeding. I don't think all Russians were affected by this. It has to be admitted, for example, the socialist revolutionaries never were. A revolutionary like Bakunin, who thought that any time and any place was suitable for making a revolution, was not much affected by historical theory. The idea of a kind of historical determinism struck him as a kind of hideous cage, which would prevent people like him from acting in this wild, free, spontaneous, and destructive manner, which is what he loved above all. There were other thinkers too. There were some among the populists in the 70s, like Kailovsky and Pisarev, who certainly didn't accept it. Tolstoy didn't accept this theory among the great writers, but then he didn't accept it because he didn't believe in history at all, because he was a man who thought that anyone who pretended to find out about the patterns of history was simply a charlatan, because there were no laws knowable to man, and anybody who pretended to know it, like sociologists or scientists, were simply telling lies. I've read all of Das Kapital, said Tolstoy. I've read it so accurately that I could be examined on it. Let me tell you, there's nothing in it. The other group of persons who were not affected by this prevailing historicism, let me tell you, and this is interesting enough, were none other than the historians. I don't say they were all unaffected. You could say that perhaps Granovsky, Solovyov the elder, the father of the philosopher, did make a formal bow to his solipsism. In their introductions, they do affect to say that history has a certain structure. Solovyov produces certain Hegelian statements. Granovsky says that history has a temper, but of course we mustn't assume it to be rigid, because nothing is more awful than a man who comfortably lies down on the bed of dogma and then proceeds not to think at all about how things really happened, and in fact a great deal more spontaneity in history than is allowed for by even the most eminent theorists, but having said these things, proceeds to write history in a perfectly normal manner. So does the greatest of all Russian historians, Trotsky. So does Platonov. So does Kareyev. So do all the most eminent historians at the turn of the century, and the Russians have had their share of profound and eminent historians, no less than any other nation. People who actually do history find that the way to write it is by sheer empirical research, of discovering what happened, when it happened, and trying to answer why it happened in terms of ordinary, non-theoretical categories. So that the myth, so to speak, really appeals not to historians, but to people in search of some kind of ersatz religion, of people who wanted a role, people who wanted them to be guaranteed happy ending, people who wanted something which would whip them on. And in modern days, this particular doctrine spread beyond the confines of thought. The whole conception, for example, of the imperatives of industrialization, of moments of takeoff, of special kind of historical launching pads from which we set off, of how to find out the exact moment at which we set off, how industrialization works. There are certain stages, that one must go through these stages, and you mustn't skip. The whole notion of following through a kind of set pattern which is created for you by nature, by history herself, has become quite an embedded view in the thinking of quite a lot of backward nations seeking to acquire power and identity through industrializing themselves on what they conceive to be the pattern of the Russian Revolution. And in this way, has had an enormous influence in Asia and in Africa. You find odd examples of it outside too. For example, if you think of Germany, for example, the Nazi Germany in the later stages of the war with Stalin. In 1945, when the Germans were losing the war very obviously, and when, so to speak, Mr. Rose died, and there was some hope in Germany that this somehow would turn the war in their favor, because America might get out of the war, or something dramatic might happen to save them. And this didn't happen. Dr. Goebbels said, this is inconceivable, that the whole of history should lead to this. Surely the rise of the Nazi Party, all these miracles which happened to Germany, cannot be wholly meaningless. And he said, history must indeed be a whore if it allows us to perish. Now this implies, so to speak, that there is some kind of godless history, that there is some kind of historical pattern which you can understand, and if only you rely upon that, you will be safe. And that history will simply turn out to be a whore, history will turn out to be meaningless, an inconceivable thought. Mussolini, when the Allied troops first landed in Sicily, and Italy was in danger, said, we're fighting, but history has us by the throat. Men, one can resist. History, scarcely. And so you get this notion that there's something, a huge impersonal force called history, which has its own patterns. If only you can find out where you belong there and hitch yourself on to the correct bit of it, then you may be sure that you'll be carried on to the next stage by forces which nothing can resist. Of course, you will make a mistake and get yourself into the wrong place, you'll be crushed by the juggernaut. But that notion of history, I think, in a sense, stems from this very pathetic, but although intelligible, desire of the Russians, particularly in the 19th century, to acquire some doctrine in terms of which they would come out top, in terms of which all their apparent disadvantages would turn into advantages, in which their backwardness and their barbarism would somehow be transmuted by some magical process into something or other, which in some sense would make them victors over the very people who they thought, at any rate, despised them and mocked them and looked down upon them. This is really the doctrine. I don't want at this particular stage to utter any general propositions about the validity or invalidity of historicism as a doctrine or as a doctrine of the patterns of history. I ought perhaps to hint to you that it seems to me that the 20th century has done very little to prop up the view that history moves in inexorable stages. I think it was the late Mr. Justice Brandeis of America who once said that the irresistible is very often merely that which people don't sufficiently try to resist. And I think there is a certain truth in that. This is all I have to say on this particular topic. There's just one thing I'd like to add. If anyone wants to ask me questions, I should be extremely happy to reply to them. But as there are a good many people in this room who've honored me by their presence, maybe it would be a good thing if there was perhaps the opposition, an interval now of say 3 or 4 minutes in which those who wish to go away can go away, and those who wish to ask me questions or discuss things with me could be left behind and come forward and ask me anything they wish. Thank you very much.
My introduction is not generous, but truthful. I'd like to thank Sir Isaiah on behalf of all of you for another very, very brilliant talk. Thank you. Here are the questions asked.
You're asking me about whether there's something peculiar about the Russians was making the work there.
Which makes them grasp things like you could.
Yes. No, I don't think so. I mean, there may be something peculiar, but I don't know that. It's always rather a feeble thing to say. National character is the very last kind of reasoning which one ought to use explaining anything, because it's on the whole circular. You're simply saying Russians are the kind of people who do this kind of thing, that's why they do them. which is not a very illuminating sort of answer. No, I try to convey, but that's not very successful, I'm afraid, that this is a situation which is fairly frequent in the case of all, not all, but anyhow, many undeveloped nations when they're faced with a combination of circumstances, namely a certain feeling of their own strength. I mean, they've come to maturity in some way, being precipitated onto a worse stage, I mean, after some period of isolation, you see, suddenly finding themselves involved in world events, and at the same time, an acute feeling of not an inferiority complex, but actual inferiority in the matter of education, of civilization, of technology. And when they're in that condition, I think you have to whistle to keep your courage up, and you feel that since the past is not there to buoy you up sufficiently, the future will be. Something must be. And any doctrine that promises that is going to be very well received. And I don't think that's confined to the Russians at all. I think we'll find exactly the same thing to various nations in Africa and Asia, as we speak, who feel that whatever may have happened in the past, they have glorious futures, that the white races, so to speak, are on the retreat, so to speak, and that there's a great deal to be done, that for many years they've lingered in darkness, but there are 800 million of them, soon there'll be a billion, or there are 100 million of them, soon there'll be half a billion, or something else of that kind. They're unexhausted, that Europeans or white, these old imperialists are plainly rather exhausted, and therefore we shall come onto the stage. The Germans felt it quite acutely in the 1770s. The Russians began feeling it, I suppose, somewhere around the 1820s. And other nations, I think, subsequently done exactly the same. I'm sure that's the feeling of, if you go to certain parts of Africa and Asia, I've no doubt that they feel that number and strength and the future is on their side. It's the old saying of the Russian traveler von Wiesin, who visited place in 1770, who said, "Ils finissent, nous commençons." They are finishing, we are beginning. So I don't think it's peculiar to the Russians, that's what I would say. I think part, I mean, it's a kind of historicism on my part to say that nations in a certain condition tend to develop this kind of consciousness, but of course I'm not altogether afraid. I inspires people so much as, I mean, it's illogical, but nothing inspires people so much as the thought that the stars in our courses are fighting for you. Although you could leave it to the stars, you don't. You feel that if you go in a certain direction and historic forces are washing you up, as they're buoying you up and moving in the same direction, you will surely win. This is certainly what buoyed up, so to speak, say, I don't know, Calvinists were equally deterministic in the wars of the 16th century. But in this case, of course, the inevitability of a revolution can be part of a determinist pattern. I mean, read Karl Marx, I mean, that's presumably what we're thinking of. If you read the works of Marx, you will find that in some sense, revolution cannot be averted. Whether it will be bloody or not will depend perhaps upon particular circumstances in which in each country it will arise. But there will be a revolution, i.e. liquidation of one class by another in some forcible way, that he regards as an absolute historical necessity. The fact that it is necessary doesn't make it less desirable from the point of view of those who are going to profit by it. The only thing is, of course, they may think that even if they do nothing at all, it will anyway, therefore why make the effort? Well, the doctrine says, that is true, it will happen, but if you accelerate it, you will shorten the birth time. At least you'll have it in your own day. People are not very satisfied to think that the revolution may take another 500 years to mature. If you think that your own efforts may actually make it happen tomorrow, That, no doubt, is a very strong form of leverage. It did. Yes, yes. Perfectly good question. In the case of the Chinese, I think we do know the answer. It is, of course, the case that when Mao began to modify Marxism by saying that it's possible to make a revolution as a result of the organization peasants, instead of waiting for the proletariat to develop, this was severely denied, as you know, by the communists of Moscow. And when, in fact, he successfully made this kind of revolution, they rather reluctantly had to swallow its results. And for a time, it didn't have to say. And this was all right, it was perfectly coherent, it was perfectly compatible and harmonious with orthodox Marxist doctrine, but of course it wasn't. There's very little in the works of Marx about peasants. Everything about peasants had to be imported afterwards. Lenin did a certain amount about trying to work out Marxist doctrine in the villages by who defined the poor peasant as being some kind of proletarian. But the idea that an agrarian country like China could make a revolution without the aid of industrial workers at all, that the industrial workers weren't even going to be the leaders of this revolution, as they at least were in 1917 in Russia, that was regarded out of all question. Therefore, when it happened, it administered the shock to the system. How many theorists around Moscow and what they think, how deep a shock it was, and how sincerely and how deeply by this time they believed in their doctrine is something I can't tell you. But if they did believe sincerely, they would certainly have suffered an extreme intellectual trauma. Well, it's a question I never know the answer to. I don't think much, but unpopular answer. Let me tell you, the old Russian sense of mission is what I ask myself about. Whoever generated the old Russian sense of mission, he certainly believed it. He certainly thought, in the famous Pushkin speech and in his great many other writings, that Russia was the Christ-bearing nation, which existed for the purpose of committing others. Even old Slavophiles like Aksakov and Chomyakov didn't really believe in the Russian mission vis-a-vis the world. I mean, they thought that they were the chosen instrument of Christian relations, and that they were the most Christian of nations, and that their medieval organization was, in fact, both the most human and the most Christian form of existence known to man. That they believed never they were there. But I don't think there's a very strong sense of missionary enterprise vis-a-vis other nations. Chomyakov didn't want to convert the English. Aksakov was not interested in converting the French. Therefore, when you say Russian tradition, people talk about the third Rome. Well, there was a monk called Celestius, it can't be denied, who did say, one Rome perished, the second Rome perished, and the third will perish no more. But the monk Celestius didn't leave a very deep imprint upon the history of the Russian Church. He lived when he lived, and there were occasionally certain antinomians who revived his words and said these sort of things. I just say, among the sectarians, probably were some rather exalted types who went preaching this kind of thing. But I think the notion of Russia as a messianic nation with a particular messianic message for the world is much exaggerated. And I think that so far as Marxism was concerned, it was really the Marxist mission which was taken over. And if you take someone like Lenin, he did not believe in the Russian mission, ever. His idea was there would be a world revolution. Russia happened to be the weakest link in the Russian structure, as it turned out, and therefore it was part of the privilege of Russia to be the first country to start the great proletarian revolution, as it fell to the privilege of the French to be the first country to embody the principles of liberty, freedom, and equality. But Russia wasn't doing it for herself, she didn't have a particular historical role, and the assumption was that once she started this great fire, it would spread over the world. When it didn't, it was an extreme development of the doctrine. Therefore, the idea of this particular unique Russian mission seems to me to be a piece of hindsight, a piece of reading backwards from the particular impression made by Marx and by people like Berdyaev and others, into the Dostoevsky, into the monk Filotheus, into certain religious writings, of this notion of the Russian mission. If you would ask an ordinary Russian intellectual around about 1850 whether he thought Russia had a special mission, I very strongly doubt if any of them would have any idea of what you meant. Too much about, because I really know very little about them. The early poets, certainly, the early poets, prominent people, it depends which side they were on. Pasternak is a bit different from Mayakovsky. Mayakovsky certainly felt himself called upon to be the tribune and the herald of the new rising world order. The poem on Lenin and the poem on Yes and so on, you see all those things where certainly he thought of as a great trumpet, which was going to trumpet forth the world revolution himself as a chosen instrument. No doubt about that. He had full sense of the mission of a bit somewhat differently interpreted in the way in which it was done in the 19th century, in a kind of violent, slightly hooliganish, arrogant, rude, awakening process. Pasternak was somewhat more complicated. Pasternak saw the revolution happen. He saw it as a cosmic event. He saw it as something elemental. He saw it as something unintelligible. He saw it as something beyond reason, something which could not be explained in terms of ordinary rational whatnot. And he accepted it as some kind of vast elemental force which the poet was forced to bow to and forced in some way to interpret. But he never committed himself to it as a tribune of it. He was never a propagandist for it. He didn't see himself as an instrument of embodying certain new revolutionary values as against old, and always stood aside from events at all times, both before the 60s, the Zhivago period, and after. The poets of the last 15 years, I simply don't know, I think they simply see themselves as voices of youth, voices of some of the different ones, voices of sometimes voices of protest, at other times simply voices of the new youth culture, inspired by Hemingway, inspired by Rachel Lindsay, inspired by, so to speak, the more noisier American poets and noisier American writers, into simply expressing their own unbridled, rich, new, healthy, vigorous, barbarous natures in a violent and memorable manner. Man does not believe in art. Man does not believe in duty. Man does not believe in the business of poetry to write poetry. Mandelstam's principal object, he was simply to write poetry. I mean, as a citizen, he may have accepted or rejected the revolution, but he wasn't either a revolutionary or a counter-revolutionary person. Mandelstam was a man who believed in art above all, salvation by art. And when the state became the kind of state that it did become, and began to persecute him and other poets, and declared itself against the kind of art which he believed in, and insisted upon carrying upon him all kinds of restrictions, and all kinds of issuing all kinds of orders which appeared to him to vulgarize and crush any kind of artistic impulse which anyone might have, he of course protested against it. But as a poet, what he really believed in was simply producing poetry, and nothing else at all. And only resisted, he felt that his integrity and his personality as a poet were being savaged by the regime. But he certainly protested against it, but he would ask Mandelstam if it was a function of poetry to behave politically at all. I doubt if he would have said it was. On the contrary, he would have said that the orders to poets to politicize themselves were in themselves absolute death to art. Let me tell you a story in this connection, if I may. Pasternak, whom I knew, once told me that in 1934, I don't think this really happened, this is the story, in 1934 he was informed that there was anti-fascist congress in Paris, to which he was summoned to come. Men appeared with a sort of some kind of morning coat and top hat, which was then thought to be proper attire for a poet appearing in Western Europe. He was put in an aeroplane and sent to Paris. He appeared on the platform that evening in Paris. There was there, Dreiser was probably presiding. A great many writers, Ian Forster, Dreiser, Rebecca West, all kinds of people, Stephen Spender, all kinds of people, you can imagine, Auden, they all appeared, almost every liberal writer in the world, you could see, of any eminence, either supported it or appeared first. It was a perfectly good liberal assemblage. And Pasternak appeared before them and said, I understand that you are here to organize the fight against fascism. Naturally, you know what my views about fascism are likely to be. Nevertheless, let me tell you one thing. Do not organize. All organization is the death of art. He said that.
The gentleman may understand.
I couldn't deny that. I wasn't trying to explain the course of Russian history in terms of the influence of historicism on a group of Russian intellectuals. And what I was merely trying to do was to say that there were more persons addicted to, or in some way under the influence of, the historicist notions than there were in any other country, and these people were, on the whole, in the end, because they believed in this so fanatically, highly effective. Once they were in power, they behaved exactly like any other group in power behaved, in relation to the circumstances which surrounded them, and tried to resist any forces which they regarded as hostile. But even so, even under the pressure of what you quite correctly say, poverty, intervention, and all the rest of it, a certain element of fanatical historicism lingered. That is to say, for example, the particular policy with regard to China, the failure to support the communists at a certain stage, was due to the fact that they had a particular theory of history in accordance with which certain events had to come first, certain events had to come later, and therefore, at that particular moment, the book said that nationalism had to be supported. The fact, for example, the communists in Germany in, say, 32, were instructed to vote in the plebiscite as they did, and were ordered not to collaborate with the social democrats against the Nazis, was due to some kind of dogmatic, historic view of the fact that there were certain situations which were called revolutionary and certain situations called non-revolutionary. In non-revolutionary situations, you created popular fronts. In revolution situations, you exacerbated existing disorders because they could only work in your favor. I'm not at the moment saying anything for or against these things, only that they spring from some kind of addiction to some kind of absolute dogmatic historical theory about the order in which events are inevitably bound to proceed. This seems to me a heritage from the 19th century. I dare say they've shaken themselves free of it now, but it's taken a very long time.
Personally,
I have thought of the dignity of England. It's perfectly true that White Man's Burden, Kipling, the general imperial instinct, so to speak, of the 19th, is a genuine form, a rather feeble form, but still a form of historicism. But that occurs only when imperialism comes under attack. It didn't occur in the 18th century, it didn't occur in the early 19th, when the empire was being created. And when England was at the height of its power, which was in the 60s and 70s, it didn't need a particular, so to speak, theory or doctrine or myth in order to sustain it. The myth came to its aid only when attacks were made upon it and when it wasn't quite so certain, when a certain amount of guilt ensued. And when people began wondering whether all this power being wisely used or wisely controlled, and by what right they held down various native populations, by this time were beginning to really sort of ferment. The same thing occurs, I should have thought, in the case of America, I'm less familiar with the facts, and I really can't tell you, but I agree with you. I don't think it's an absolute and necessary condition for being inspired by historicist myths, so to speak, that you should be backward. My position is the opposite, that if you are backward, you are liable to use these myths as some kind of prop or some kind of sentence. But that people in non-inferior positions feel themselves inspired to march forward if some convenient myth drives them forward, such as you say, Manifest Destiny, or the American Century, or things of that kind. That this does happen is, of course, not to be denied. I'm not saying that countries, in full clinging to the power, never have these myths. Only that countries which are not in clinging to the power, and in some sense mean to get somewhere, because they feel an enormous accession of strength and some degree puzzle them, so to speak, some degree of ignorance about how to use it. These people seem to be most liable to fall under the domination of those myths. Yes, I see that.
I think maybe we can have one more question. I think we presume.
Here what they do. That really would involve, no doubt, taking into account a very great many factors. I was only confining myself to the rather narrow question of what kind of situations are the situations in which historicist models particularly appeal to communities, whatever the other factors involved may be. I mean, it's quite obviously true that no country.